What's up, everyone, and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, where we cover how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm your host, Mike DiSebato, and we are back after a nice long hiatus where nothing interesting happened at all, especially not in the U.S. Anyway, today we are going to discuss two stories. First, how vaccines are made available to low and middle income countries, and then we discuss a drilling auction that happened for the Arctic refuge that was met with lackluster interest. Thanks as always for joining us. Stay tuned. Vaccine distribution has always been set on an inequitable foundation. For example, measles, pertussis, and tetanus were responsible during the early 1990s for nearly 2 million deaths in developing countries, but no deaths were attributable to them in industrialized countries, and this was due to the availability of vaccines. The reason for this inequitable foundation is because a number of factors work together to thwart attempts to raise vaccine coverage rates in low-income countries. Fragile or non-existent health service infrastructure, difficult geographical terrain, and at times armed conflict. Those are just three I'm going to mention right now. There's also something we have talked a lot about on this podcast, the lack of market for vaccines compared to much more profitable niche drugs. Vaccines are administered only a couple times throughout someone's life, where niche drugs for long-term diseases are taken regularly, so there isn't as large of a market for them as many would like to see. This is especially true in countries that aren't that monetarily wealthy. So to combat this, and to create a market where one is needed, many low-income countries have historically established these things called Advanced Market Commitments, or AMCs. An AMC is a legally binding agreement through which funds are provided to pharmaceutical companies or vaccine companies, basically, in advance by governments or NGOs or multinational organizations like the WHO or UNICEF. And what the AMC does is it purchases a potential treatment, e.g. a vaccine, against a specific disease, and it secures doses for whomever purchased that. And it's usually that AMCs are used by low-income countries, but in the years of the COVID-19 pandemic, where demand has skyrocketed for a certain vaccine, AMCs have been used by high-income countries as well to secure doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. So what does this all mean now for the market and for the distribution of vaccines around the world? Well, to help understand that, I called up my colleague Namita Nair because she recently wrote a report on this very subject. And what I wanted to first understand was how these AMCs were currently being put into operation.
So most of the companies have been financed by high-income countries. So you will see that these AMCs have resulted in a large number of extra doses for countries like the United States, Canada, the European Union. But where companies have been financed by multilateral organizations like the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, these are for the lower income and the lower middle income countries, but the doses are not exactly in tandem with the requirements of the populations of these countries. So that's the most important takeaway from the AMC distribution pattern.
And that's because usually when the pandemic isn't going on, when you have a vaccine that you need to distribute in a low-income country, you have these multinational organizations like the Melinda Gates Foundation that secures an AMC and then is able to spread out a vaccine throughout a market. But with COVID-19, there is such a rush and such a global demand that the AMCs have been centered in basically two places, the US and the EU. For the companies we cover, meaning publicly traded companies basically, there are only three companies that have AMCs right now with low to middle income countries. That's AstraZeneca, Novavax, and Sanofi GSK. We are going to get into what this all means for the companies that I just mentioned and the industry in general, but I should just note that this sort of unequal distribution of a vaccine is important for us to note because it makes it more difficult for everyone, for our economy, for investors, for anybody listening, to step away from this pandemic.
You know, a commitment to equitable distribution is important from the get-go because even the WHO has opined that without equitable distribution, we cannot expect good outcomes. The pandemic is not going to go away just because a small group of countries or a small population has access to the vaccine. It really needs equitable distribution to go away.
What was interesting for me when I was talking with Namita was if the company has already established this product and they're distributing it out and they've got it figured out, it made me think of economies of scale and why they wouldn't just try to get it into the hands of everyone they can. What I mean by that is if you can use the COVID-19 pandemic as a company as an excuse to set up a medical infrastructure in a company that doesn't have one yet, and then you would be the main contact for that infrastructure. Then why wouldn't a company try to do that? And I'm not saying that to try to promote the establishment of a private medical industry in countries far away. I'm just more curious about why we don't see more companies, once they put in the legwork and gotten the cash needed to put in the R&D and develop a vaccine, why they don't spread it to low-income countries. So I asked Namita why that might not be.
Well, we would expect the company to be doing something like this, but IP rights are a big barrier to getting this sort of stuff off the ground. So many, many countries that are part of the, you know, the World Trade Organization still expect that the intellectual property rights for COVID-19 therapies be respected. There has been repeated calls for, maybe not enforcing these rights strictly during a pandemic period, but there's been no decision in that area as yet. So this would be one of the biggest barriers for a company to just go out and do it, because enforcing or even doing technical transfer to a company that does not respect IP rights. Most companies would are of the opinion that IP rights are the main reason why they are able to innovate.
So intellectual property rights, companies seem to be worried that if they lose control of their products by giving them away, they will lose their ability to be a going concern, to continue to be innovative. But right now, that strikes me as kind of a systemic risk within the global healthcare system. And the reason I say that is because most of the companies have committed to not making a profit off of these vaccines for a set period of time.
So basically now, profit making would be a very dicey thing, because you're getting money from a government to do the R&D. So your R&D costs have been subsidized by government money. And making a profit during a pandemic would be really bad optics for a company. So I think most of them have explicitly said that. But also the issue is that these sort of non-profit making statements have been restricted to the pandemic period. And that is something a company can determine on its own. So AstraZeneca, I think, has said that it is going to consider the pandemic period until June or July of 2021. That's it.
There's also the structure of the AMC itself that makes a profit look a bit dodgy. When you enter into an AMC, you are basically getting a check from someone that's really in need, and they are saying, can you please help us save these people from this problem, or save our people from this problem? Making money off of that need isn't always a great look, yet that disparity exists, and so there's going to be differences between the regions when they get their vaccines and how they get their vaccines. One thing we are paying attention to a lot more this year is how inequality has grown. A lot of the focus goes toward economic inequality as seen via wage disparity or pay or things like that. But we are also looking at this sort of systemic inequality when it comes to access to healthcare. And in our mind, companies that can help repair a bit of that unequal foundation may see opportunity beyond altruism. As Namita wrote in her report, companies that distribute COVID-19 vaccines in low and middle income countries could benefit not only from reputational gains, but also face future growth opportunities with increased penetration of underserved markets. But there's a major difference between a company that promises to try and help a region and a company that can actually help that region. The distinction comes down to two factors: commitment and preparedness.
So if a company has a track record of very low involvement in product safety and quality issues, and it has not faced regulatory fines or any reputational fallout because of issues with its products, and if it has an infrastructure that consists of a good oversight of its supply chain, it has a strong, robust, quality management system. So these things would mean that a company is well prepared to scale up, and is also probably going to ensure that wherever it has presence, so even if it is going to do technical transfer, know-how transfer, and if it's going to expand its presence into other countries rather than its home country, it is well prepared to ensure the quality of the product and the quantity of scale-up.
So take AstraZeneca, a company that Namita has mentioned before. It's this British and Swedish multinational pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical company. It has committed the most doses of COVID-19 vaccine of any company out there at 3 billion, and 1.3 billion of that 3 billion is for low and middle income countries. The promising thing about AstraZeneca is they have a great quality control and production safety measure set up, and they have really good supply chain oversight. So there is confidence that they can scale up their production and do it well. And that is important because a company can make an extremely effective vaccine, but unless they have the tools available to scale up their production, that vaccine will only help a small number of people, which is good, yes, but not enough to fight a global pandemic.
Another very unique example would be Novavax. So this company has never commercialized a vaccine. It has never commercialized a product ever. And now it has committed to a very large number of doses of the vaccine, which about 1 billion are going to be for low and lower middle income countries. And the issue is that the company has already faced delays in its late stage clinical trials because it has had issues with the sourcing of the vaccine candidate.
There's also the difference in how the vaccine needs to be stored. Pfizer's synthetic mRNA vaccine requires storage and transportation through a cold chain of minus 70 degrees Celsius. In contrast, Moderna's vaccine requires storage of negative 20 degrees Celsius. And then if you think of AstraZeneca and Novavax, they have vaccine candidates that can be stored and distributed even more easily at 2 to 8 degrees Celsius. Those are temperatures that can be achieved in a normal commercial refrigerator. What this means for us and what this means for investors in these companies is that all these factors will affect how easily a company can meet the demands it has put onto itself or that has been put onto itself by the organizations it has partnered with. There are all the factors that Namita mentioned. The availability and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines are intrinsically dependent on a company's preparedness to manufacture and meet the unprecedented demand. There's a reality that if we don't get all the global regions vaccinated, we may be stuck with travel bans and repeated outbreaks for some time. There are also a number of state-run companies that we didn't discuss in China and in Russia that are administering their own vaccine at the moment and elsewhere, and how that will play out is still yet to be seen. It brings nuance to the videos of vaccines being administered, and while the world is alit with the possibility that there will soon be an end to the grief we are all feeling, there's this lingering awareness that there's still much more to come. So last Wednesday, January 6, before there was the attempted insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, the Trump administration held an auction for the sale of drilling leases in a pristine Arctic wildlife refuge, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR for short. The auction didn't really go that well. There were only 16 bids on 12 of the 22 tracts that were offered. Most of the bids were made by the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority that has been trying to open up ANWR for some time. To make sense of all this, which was a victory for environmentalists and indigenous groups, but a disappointment for Alaskan leaders, I have with me my colleagues Antonios Panagiotopoulos and Chris Coates, who wonderfully offered to give me some spice, some hot takes on what is going on here. And Antonios, I wanted to first start with you. Is the Arctic a place oil and gas companies see it viable or not really?
Yeah, the Arctic has been a place of interest for many companies along the years, especially in cases where you have a high oil price, because as we were talking about, it is quite an expensive process to drill in the Arctic. There have been companies like Shell where they said that they would not drill again in the Arctic. There have been companies like Total that they were saying that they would not drill where there is ice, which can be a bit controversial. But then again, you have companies that have made no commitments to that they can drill in the Arctic. There are investors that have taken commitments not to invest in companies that are drilling in the Arctic. So that, if you like, completes the circle. But now, with the specifically with the ANWR opening up for lease, for sale, you will see at least some companies being interested to explore those. Although it is more likely that those are going to be smaller, more niche companies, most likely focused in this specific part of exploration and production.
Okay, Chris, I kind of want to shift to you here because I want to understand the broader political context here. What do you think about this move by the outgoing Trump administration to sort of rush this auction onto the books 2 weeks before the Biden inauguration?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the Trump administration wanted to get this done as a sort of a political objective they had. It's long been a Republican priority to open up the ANWR for drilling. And so, he checked the box. And the oil majors didn't show interest. The main bidder was, for all intents and purposes, the state of Alaska, right? And so this Alaskan corporation acted as a backstop. They submitted, low bids near the minimum. And what it does is it preserves some optionality for these oil majors or other companies to join on in the future if they want. They could partner with this Alaskan corporation, which isn't a driller, doesn't have any equipment in its own right. This is obviously a high-profile time for this sale to go up in the last weeks of the Trump administration. There's a lot of political pressure. And by not bidding, they've avoided this, but they've still preserved the option to join on in the future if they want. Also, the oil market is in a very uncertain time right now. Their supply is still very high. Companies' finances are in a difficult situation in many cases. So this wasn't a good time for them either, I would think. So we may see more action down the road. We may not.
Okay, good. I always like ending on an ambiguous note, especially when it comes to the protection of a natural treasure. And that's it for the week. I wanted to thank Namita, Antonios, and Chris for joining me to discuss this week's news with an ESG twist. And I wanted to thank you so much for listening. I hope you're not letting the existential stress of this entire week crush you, and take care of yourself and make sure you're stepping away to take a breath during all this madness. Also, if you like what you heard, don't forget to rate and review us. That always helps. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. That helps as well. Thanks so much, and talk to you next week.
The MSCI ESG Research podcast is provided by MSCI Inc.'s subsidiary, MSCI ESG Research LLC, a registered investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. And this recording and data mentioned herein has not been submitted to nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. None of the discussion or analysis put forth in this recording constitutes an offer to buy or sell, or a promotion or recommendation of any security, financial instrument, or product or trading strategy. Further, none of the information is intended to constitute investment advice or recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.